Micah 7, the reading of verse 18. Who is a God like unto thee that pardoneth iniquity and passeth by the transgressions of the remnants of his heritage? He retaineth not his anger forever, because he delighteth in mercy. He will turn again. He will have compassion upon us. He will subdue our iniquities, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. Thou wilt perform the truth to Jacob, and the mercy to Abraham, which thou hast sworn unto our fathers from the days of old. And may God bless the reading of his word. We know scarcely anything about Micah. His name means who is like God, and a lot of people have suggested that that is really a pseudonym that the writer of this book used in order to disguise his own personality. That quite plainly is not true. Jeremiah 26, which was written a century later, refers to Micah and the opposition to his ministry and how people treated him. And because of the comparative leniency that they showed to him, it was argued that Jeremiah also ought to be shown similar leniency. So he was a historical personage. His name almost unquestionably was actually Micah. He lived in very humble circumstances, apparently. Not a city dweller, but one who inhabited a fairly small town. A town located in one of the valleys that reached up from the coastal plain to the Judean highlands surrounding Jerusalem. He could climb the hills from time to time and see what was going on. His town of Moresheth was only 26 miles southwest of Jerusalem. It's only 20 miles from the seacoast. And if he traveled up certain hills, he might see quite easily the glint of the sun upon the Mediterranean Sea. Also, he could see that great coastal road which ran from north to south. He could see the caravans of travelers and traders passing that way. He could see the pilgrims coming up in order to pay their worship to God at Jerusalem. He could see the individuals and the companies. And later on he also saw the large armies of invaders sweeping down that same road. He could see the horses and the horses and chariots coming out from Egypt and to make their way across the Lachish, there to be accommodated. So in some ways he was not in a backwater, although the town in which he lived was so relatively small. He lived in circumstances, so far as the nation was concerned, which were rather peculiar to his own time. If you read the book of Amos, you discover that there are parallels there. Wealthy merchant princes had arisen, were crushing the peasantry and dispossessing them of their own property. There were others who were paying the judges to secure verdicts acceptable to themselves. There seemed to be no honesty and no justice in the land. And Micah, like Amos, describes conditions of that character. It shows quite clearly the shortcoming of the people. His prophecy probably can be dated about the year 750 B.C. Quite obviously, he did write it prior to the Assyrian invasion of Israel in 722 to 721 B.C. Well, that had not yet occurred, and he refers to it in his prophecy as an event that still lies in the future. So probably about 750 B.C. was the date for his starting of his prophecy. He told the story in detail, but in marvelous imagery. His book is quite easily divisible. He sets the whole story of the whole scene in chapter 1 and shows the eternal God coming down to earth to take up his place on the throne from which he is going to execute judgment. And then in chapters 2 and 3, he argues against those in various classes who've done wrong in the sight of God and done harm to God's people. Four different classes are referred to. Then in chapter 4, he shows what God has in view, ultimately, the possibility of a revival of religion and a restoration in the full to the worship of God. In chapter 5, he shows how clearly that can be accomplished only through one person and his work. And then in chapters 6 and 7, he gives those great controversies, or possibly the one great controversy, of God with Israel. He prophesied in the days of Joseph, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Recall that Ahaz, the king of Judah, introduced the worship of the Baalim into his country, the worship of the deities of those lands around him, and also went so far as to offer his own son in the fire to Moloch. Hezekiah, who followed him, was a king of a different character. Through him, a revival came to the country, a spiritual revival, a turning back to God. But the revival was not perfect. There were shortcomings in many respects. The idolatry certainly was not fully dealt with. Micah almost unquestionably participated in the revival that came in the days of Hezekiah. That is the background to the whole story. Now notice how Micah deals with it. In rather a strange manner, he shows the whole world as a kind of amphitheater in which God is coming down to set a court of justice and to act as judge. The mountains of the world are regarded as national powers, and the smaller powers are pictured as hills. So you have a great circular plane. The mountains and hills surrounding it, as though they are witnesses in a court of law. A rather curious setting for what he is going to say. And that characterizes the whole book. For in chapters 6 and 7, he completes the story and shows what God has said, not merely as judge, but as prosecutor as well. He pictures the coming of God as many of the Old Testament prophets and Psalms do. He comes with a thunder, the thunder storm, with the clouds and the lightning, and the roll of the thunder. He comes also with the earthquake. And Micah portrays the scene. There stand the mountains, with the lava rolling down the mountain's side. The hills themselves melt like wax, and right through those valleys that surround them, right up to the Judean highlands, he sees carved deep channels. Then the torrential rains pour down their volume of water into the valleys and through these channels. The coming of God to earth is an event concerning which all nature seems to take account. And God sits there in earth, in his court, to judge his own people of Israel and Judah. For Micah, although of Judah, spoke to Israel as well as his own native country. The whole message is not merely to Judah, but to Israel as well. He tells the story of what happens almost immediately. Trouble is coming. God's people have chosen their own way. They have pursued their own course, And God inevitably reacts in punishment upon them. Michael stands upon a hillside. Again he changes his picture and looks across that great coastal rand. He sees the army rushing down. Possibly the army of Sennacherib. Possibly later on he might visualize also the Chaldean forces. But immediately, probably the army of Sennacherib. Pulling down the coastal rand in all its ferocity and impetuosity. Then turning suddenly up the valleys that lead to the holy city. And through valley after valley, the armies pour in all their power and force. And they capture town after town, in some cases raising them to the ground, and make their force felt through all the valleys of the Judean highlands. They come to Gath. They come to city after city, village after village, and capture every one of the towns and villages which they face. The Micah does a rather curious thing. He takes the meaning of each of those cities and each of those towns and villages, and not the primary meaning in scarcely any one case. He takes a secondary and sometimes a tertiary meaning, and uses that to indicate the kind of punishment that God is going to inflict. The army sweeps up the small town of Gath, not far from Micah's own home of Manasseh. It captures Gath and puts the inhabitants to suffering and torture. Then Micah says virtually, "Do you know what Gath means?" And he does not take the primary significance of the city, the meaning that one would commonly give to it. He said it means tell or talk. And if others confirm his attitude towards Gath, tell it on in Gath and publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. A city that tells or talks. He was quite justified in so doing. The inhabitants of Gath were known as talkers and as busybodies, interfering in other people's business and so on. So, as the army takes Gath, it is only fitting that should occur. And now, you inhabitants of Gath, no longer can you tell or talk. No longer can you be busybodies. That has all come to an end, for Gath has fallen to the invader. Tell it not in Gath. There's no more talking, no more conversing. No more busybody making. Gath has come to his end. They take Achor. He doesn't mention the name of the town, but implies it through what he said. And one of the meanings given to Achor was weeping or lamentation. Achor also falls to the hand of the invader. Achor is taken. The city of weeping, says Micah. Now you shall never weep again. The tears will be dry. And despite the suffering through which you are passing, no lamentations shall be made. No more weeping, although Achor has been taken. Then we come to Aphra. Aphra, one of the meanings of which is dust. You'll recall possibly that one of the messages of mourning among the heathen nations around Israel and Judah was a placing of dust upon the head. If you were following the body of a loved one to burial, you'd put dust upon your head. That, of course, was forbidden to God's people. But Aphra, the city of dust, that too fell to the invader. And Micah says, you also shall know the meaning of Aphra. You'll not merely put dust upon your head, but you're round in the dust. Sorrow and suffering will be yours. Sorrow incomparable. Aphra shall have its full meaning in your case. They come to Saphir. the beautiful city, the city of loveliness, and so on. He says the city that prided herself on her beautiful buildings, and prided herself also on all that was discoverable in the town. He talked about the beautiful countryside around, the city of beauty and loveliness shall be stripped naked, and all its shame discoverable by the truth. He's using picture form to convey his message. As the army sweeps up the valleys, surely there's some escape. Surely there's some way of evading their attack. There is Zanon to which they come. Zanon, the place of marching, the place where quite literally people did march, gather together and train themselves in military discipline. No more marching in Zanon, says Micah. Marching has finished. There's no possible escape from trouble that is coming. Zanon, too, shall fall to the hand of the invader. Suffering, which they have never experienced, shall be theirs now. No escape? But quite close to those lateral towns of Beth Ezel, the neighbor, refuge, shelter, is the not shelter for some? May not some people flee and find a shelter or a refuge from that evil invader? No, Beth Ezel also falls. The neighborly kindness that might have been shown is snatched away. There's no escape, no way of deliverance. No refuge offered. The army sweeps over all the towns. Meroth, good, is turned into evil. In other cases, the very opposite of the meaning of the town becomes true. That which should be a present to some is a present to the evil one. Where one should have told the truth is turned into a lie. An evil action, which itself means deceit, becomes a lie to the rulers of Israel. Then finally he comes down through Marisheth, to Marisheth. That's a present, of course. It's going to be a present, not to those to whom it belongs. That would be impossible. But to the invader. Marisheth too. Micah's own hometown shall fall to the invader. Lachish, where the horses were stalled, and the chariots, the town of horses, shall provide those security. Lachish also shall fall. Right through the whole story, town after town, village after village, falls to the invader. Until finally, with a glimpse of hope, the glory comes to Adullam. Adullam that was despised, the home of a gang of outlaws. To Adullam, the glory of Israel comes. This is rather a strange picture. But you see the obvious significance, don't you? Isn't there a significance also? Possibly to people like you and me. For those people who are no different from us. We don't possess virtues that they did not possess. And the characteristics of those towns and villages of so many centuries ago are the characteristics of those who live in the present day. You may still find in churches of God today features of the kind described by Micah. Those of Gath, the talkers, the busybodies, those who stir up trouble by scandal, and by talking about others, why, well, was forgot of it in Scotland. Of course, one doesn't talk like that here. You wouldn't get that kind of thing. But you do in some countries. The busybody, the slanderer. Don't you know Mrs. So-and-so? Didn't you see? She was wearing earrings and jewelry. It's a shame. And have you noticed Mr. Sozo has a new car? Spending all that money on a Mercedes. And did you hear what Sozo did? And he's a well-known preacher. The touch of scandal, or the word of the busybody, is destroying gradually the reputation of another. You may not find it in your company, but may I be quite blunt, you'll find it in many companies of God's people. And the damage that is done by the idle word and by the slanderous remark is almost far beyond our imagination. You can't restore what you have taken away by your idle word. Gas falls to the invader. Oh, there are those who follow the path of Echo and Aphra. Haven't you found them? Well, possibly not. You may be too young. But if you're as old as I am, and of course I'm very old, if you're as old as I am, you'd know them quite well. They sit down, and they repine and they lament. They talk about the glorious days of the past. They moan over the present day, over the character of the young people. Things are not what they ought to be. They're certainly not what they used to be. In some ways, don't tell them. I think that's a good thing. But you know the sort of people, don't you? No possibility of any improvement. The whole thing is dying and will rapidly disappear. In fact, only in this country, I won't tell you just where, but not so very long ago, a brother said to me, I don't think there'll be any assemblies in 10 years' time. Another brother who was standing with him said, I think perhaps that's rather exaggerated. It may be less than 10 years. That's the kind of talk that's going on. Of course there are problems today. Problems that we didn't see years ago. Assemblies in many places are being torn asunder by certain teaching on pneumatology and in some cases on eschatology. They're being torn asunder by this kind of teaching or that kind of teaching. There are problems in life today which did not exist when we were younger. Of course there are. And some of them quite serious problems too. Well, some I know quite well. There are two divorce cases. There are two lesbians. That in one assembly alone. Of course there are problems. Well, I say, we ought to be lamenting. We ought to be weeping. We ought to be humbling ourselves in the dust. But wait a moment. Are you going to travel the same path? And say, God's arm is shortened, that he cannot save. His ear heavy, that he cannot hear. The good old days of which we sometimes speak were not quite so glorious and golden as we like to think. And God is working today, as much as ever he was working in the days gone by. Don't sit down and lament, and mourn over the past, and deprive the present. With all these marvelous, incomparable opportunities. Get on with a job. Realize God has put you just where you are. There and nowhere else you might live for and glorify him. There are those in churches today of the same character as these people of long ago. There are liars. There are hypocrites. There are men and women who are not ashamed or not afraid to tell untruth. And well might we think about it and pray about it. But why give up? Why give up? If you don't face the issue and alter your way, there's one who sits in the court, one who listens to the cry, who knows quite well what the conditions are, and who inescapably will issue his verdict in the coming day. You cannot go on as you are at the moment. You think I'm exaggerating? Well, it was a few years ago now. A brother came to me. He had retired from business as a bank manager. He said he was hoping to do something something in the Lord's way. Well, I was on the council of a Jewish society at that time, and we're looking for a new treasurer. I thought he might be an excellent man for the job. I said, what do you know about Jewish work? He said, nothing. I said, well, have you ever been interested in it? He said, no, really, I haven't. Well, I thought they were frank enough anyhow. But I suggested his name. After the meeting where he was questioned regarding his application to take up this post, one of the questions that was put was the obvious one. Are you interested in Jewish work? And how long have you been interested? Do you know what he said? I've been interested in Jewish work all my life. It was a downright lie. He got the job. It was a downright lie. And you can magnify illustrations of it. How do you think you can expect blessing in circumstances of that character? That's what Micah is saying. People with those characteristics are going to pass under the hand of the invader. He is using symbolism, of course. He's using imagery to convey his message. But the implications are perfectly clear, aren't they? There is one who sits on the throne, who's there in the court, and who shortly will issue his verdict. So the army rose on until it comes to a gallop. Then in chapters 2 and 3, Micah is even more blunt. He turns to the various sorts of the people and denounces them and spells out their true character. He turns to those wealthy traders, those who made money by every possible means. He says, you lie in your bed. All the evening while you're lying there, when you should be sleeping, you're conjuring up in your mind what new plot you can lay, or what new scheme you can construct. I've got these houses. I would add others to them. I have those fields. I will ask for others also. And you know quite well what you intend to do. And in the morning when you wake, you said about putting into effect what you have already planned. There are the oppressed peasantry, oppressed by you and others like you. And you dispossess them of their inheritance. You rob them of what belongs to them. And you think you'll escape. There's no possibility in your mind of any restoration of what you have stolen. You've taken it and made it permanently yours. You know quite well what the law says. You cannot keep that which belongs to another man. Even if you had bought it, you must restore it in the year of Jubilee. But you have added land to land and house to house and think forever to retain what you have taken. There is one, he says, by implication, who sits in the court, one who listens to the plea, and knows quite well what is occurring, and inevitably he'll give his verdict. Then he turns to the rulers, through whom, of course, this kind of happening is permitted, or through whom it comes into effect. Were they just rulers, that kind of thing could never occur. The rulers are therefore culpable in the sight of God. Don't misunderstand me. All rule and authority are derived from God. That does not mean that the individual who occupies the office is appointed by God. No one would suggest, for example, that Idi Amin of Uganda was God's appointed ruler of that country. But those who were in Uganda at that time ought to have prayed for the powers that be. Sometimes one thinks of other rulers. If you recognize a prime minister who's married to a divorced man, who covers up nepotism from time to time, who obstinately chooses her own course, you may say, that's not the kind of ruler I desire. But all the same, Whether you regard her as the most suitable person or not, you pray for the powers that be. Rule and authority ultimately are derived from Almighty God. Therefore, the rulers are responsible to God, whether it be on the in the highest place on the land, whether it be in smaller organizations. If you are in control of individuals or organizations, you know quite well you are responsible as a Christian, not merely to your organization. You're responsible ultimately to Almighty God. But I repeat, all rules, all authority, ultimately are required from God Himself. And rightly therefore He turns to the rulers and denounces them for all their shortcomings and failures. And then He turns to others. There are the prophets and the priests. And He refers to the priests almost incidentally in His message to the prophets. The prophets are false prophets. They should be telling the truth of God, revealing His will and purpose for mankind. All they are doing is to comfort the people, tell them they may drink, they may do what they like, and all will be well. A comfortable kind of religion. You don't need to bother about wrongdoing. You don't need to be concerned about sin. Let's all go together, enjoy life, and be happy in the comfortable thought that eventually all will be well. The most popular doctrine in Judah and in Israel, a most popular doctrine in the world today, and even in churches of the character with which we are associated. Is it always true that the prophet stands up with a clear, emphatic statement that this is what the Lord says, that what He is declaring is the mind of God, confirmed and made clear by the statements of Scripture? What is sometimes the comfortable word which glosses over the undesirable, which covers up the wrongdoing? God speaks, and the prophet lies. There's one who sits in the court, and by whom sentence presently will be pronounced. It is inescapable, utterly inevitable. The priest, who should have been a teacher of the law, who should have told the people what to do and guided them in detail, is silent when he ought to speak. But a lot of shame, isn't it? But is it quite so remote from the conditions of the present day? You may say it's not quite pertinent to our particular church or to the company that I know. But if you pause to think, it may be relevant to some other church of which you are aware. And unless yours is a supernatural church, perhaps that's a wrong way of putting it. Unless yours is an exceptional church, I rather guess that some of these things might be true even of the place with which you're associated. Now that's rather rude. I suppose I ought to apologize. I'm not going to do so. Think of chapter 4. And God says quite simply, after a picture of that character, one day, the temple that in future is going to be destroyed will be rebuilt. And the hill Moriah was kind of all the other mountains. For the Micah is referring symbolically to the triumph of that spiritual religion. Whether he's talking quite literally of the geographical changes that are going to occur in that land of Israel, I don't know. Whether he's taken as literal or symbolic, one thing is perfectly clear. In the coming day, there will be the temple, and the nations of the earth will go up to the temple to bring their worship, their homage, to Jehovah Himself. Of that fact, there's no debate at all. Zechariah talks about the same thing. Says, in the coming day, people will go up annually to Jerusalem to bring their worship, their tribute to God himself. Isn't that a lesson for us also? There has been one set on high, and him already we bring our tribute. And all that, of course, is quite impossible. How could it occur in circumstances of that character? And then Micah reveals the whole secret. There's coming a day, he says, when not of tiny Bethlehem will come one who is from everlasting days, or from the days of eternity. Not some new person, but one who always was and ever will be. He'll come forth from Bethlehem Ephratah, the tiny town in Judah. Of the identity of that one, there is no doubt whatsoever. When Herod called the priests and scribes to him, he said, where will the Messiah be born? And without any hesitation whatsoever, those who knew the scriptures said, Michael says, in Bethlehem. And they quoted these verses. There will he be born, at the Bethlehem, Herod said. There's no doubt as to what occurred. Adam had erected a barrier between man and... Forgive me for this, I just can't help it. Adam had erected a barrier between man and God. There is no possibility of removing the barrier. Man has sinned. Only by man could that sin be dealt with. Only by the death of man could the penalty be paid. There is no man, no one, whose life was clean and spotless. No one could by any means redeem his brother or present an offering for him. The life of everyone was forfeited because he was sinful. As children of Adam, we've inherited his nature. Therefore, we are sinful too. No one could stand in the place of his brother. Mankind was condemned. But Almighty God came forth in the person of man, and in the person of man answered to the need and satisfied that question. The one who came at Bethlehem was no new personality. He was one who always was and always will be. Only he became God-man, who's still the same person. When an ordinary babe is born into the world, a new life comes. A new personality enters this scene. That was not the case at Bethlehem 19 centuries ago. The Eternal came into time and appeared as man and lived on two time scales at the same time. While on earth, he was still in the heavens of earth. While living here as a tiny child, he was still controlling the whole of creation, and showing his will in every part of sentient life. A new personality, by him, reconciliation became possible. He took the place of mankind, reconciled man to God, made a way of access into the presence of God. Now the guilty sinner comes to God through Jesus Christ and finds a way, a life, a new nature. So Micah gives the story. He shows how these things will be accomplished. Only by the entrance of God into this world and into man's experience. Only by the work of Calvary's cross can the work of reconciliation be effected. He tells the story in those few verses in chapter in chapter 5. Then in chapters 6 and 7, we find the controversy of God with his people. How is it that I've wearied you, says God? My little story He has sat as judge, and also acted as prosecutor, and now he descends from the throne and stands before his people. There the judge and prosecutor faces the people themselves. There the criminal digs his head to talk with them and to reason the whole story with those who have sinned. What's gone wrong? How has life wearied you in this way? Why this attitude? Why this relationship to me? Why? Now you know what to do, don't you? You know your condition. You know what to do. If you have any doubt, go back to your own scriptures. Don't you remember the old story of Balak and Balaam? Balaam, who had been told on two times what God's will was, chose his own course. Three times came that obstruction, and he still chose his own way. Three times he tried to earn what had been offered to him, and lost. Eight times he had heard and refused to listen. And eventually Balak, whose eyes probably were more wide open than those of Balaam, said to Balaam, "I've sinned. My deities are of no value. It's been shown quite clearly that there is a greater God. Jehovah, the God of Israel, is greater than the deities of Moab. What can I do? I've offended him. By what you have done, in the words you have uttered, you've shown quite clearly his superiority over all the deities I have worshipped. What can I do to appease him? Shall I bring cattle or thousands of sheep? Shall I bring thousands of rivers of oil? I'm even prepared to offer my own son as a sacrifice to him. But tell me, Balaam, what shall I do?" You know the story, says God. Let me tell you what Balaam said. All that God requires is that you to do justly, and love mercy, and walk humbly with God. That's the answer. Tell me, Balaam, what shall I do? You know the story, says God. Let me tell you what Balaam said. All that God requires is that you to do justly, and love mercy, and walk humbly with God. That's the answer. To do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with God. That says God, what Balaam said to Balak is pertinent to you too. That's the answer. You know quite well what you are. You know the conditions in which you live. You know what's going on around you. You know the state of the church generally. What's the answer? To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. Now don't sit there looking so smug. That's what God's saying today. To do justly. But you don't, do you? Are you really honorable and completely just in your attitude to those around you, and particularly to those who are Christians? To do justly. Are you? And love mercy. That's about the last thing you'll expect on assemblies. Don't think I'm being caustic. To love mercy. In one assembly with which I was associated, there's a young Scot, a fine young fellow, who'd been used very greatly in work among young fellows. One day he was discovered in sin, sentenced to 3 years imprisonment. Quite rightly, and the assembly immediately excommunicated him. I said to one of the elders, wouldn't it be wise to wait and see whether there's an appeal? His words were quite blunt. We're glad to get rid of him. And he's put out of fellowship. During the whole of the time he was in prison, not one of the elders went to see him. Not one offered any help. During that time, he was the means of leading a Belfast murderer to Christ. I'm not saying that excused his crime for one second. To show that possibly God had more mercy than his brethren. When he came out of prison, no one from his assembly was there, but a man he'd never met was at the gate. A Christian man, with his car, he took him home. Gave him a home, found him a job, set him on his own feet. The brethren showed no mercy. And years later, as I was talking to one of those brethren about him, he said, oh, he was a bad egg. I'd had news of him since that time. I said, well, do you know what he's doing now? I told him about the work for God that this young fellow was doing. Rather so, he led to Christ. He said, well, I can't accept that. He was a bad egg. That is typical of a certain type of mind. Only too unfortunately, it's a spirit that is discoverable in many assemblies. I've often been told you find far more mercy in churches than you do in assemblies. Don't think I'm being harsh, but it's true. Brethren never forget, and they never forgive. They talk about forgiveness and mercy and compassion. They never forget, and consequently, never forgive. They said God to Israel, this is the way. Do justly. Love mercy. Haven't you experienced mercy? Don't you know the compassion of God? Haven't I shown you in every possible way my love to you? Show mercy and walk humbly with thy God. That's the hardest part of it all. Walk humbly. You can't, can you? Oh, after all, I'm somebody. After all, I deserve some respect. I'm not going to be treated as a doormat. I'm not going to allow Brother so-and-so to say that kind of thing about me. I'm not going to tolerate that kind of attitude. And walk humbly with thy God. What a change it would make if that attitude were adopted. I remember on one occasion, Harold Sinding was asked, in Scotland too, about a certain brother. Those of you who remember Harold Sinding would remember the character he was. In many ways a saint. These young fellows who were asking him the question were trying by every means possible to get him to say something rude about the man they were discussing. This man who probably merited what they had in mind. Harold Sinding looked round at them rather quizzically. He said, what a charming wife he has, hasn't he? Oh, he's dodging the issue, of course, you'll say. Walk humbly with thy God. How dare I criticize my brother? I was taken from the gutter of sin and brought by the saving work of Christ into the family of God. So was my brother. Dare I criticize him for whom Christ died, for whom in love he gave himself? Walk humbly with thy God. So Micah comes to his ending picture. And forgive me, I've already gone 5 minutes over time, and I won't go much more. He comes to his closing message. Who's a pardoning God like thee? That's virtually what he's saying. One with grace so rich and free. One of compassion. One of mercy. Oh, Judah and you, and so did Israel. The mercy and compassion of God were so evident in the divine dealings with them. Who's a God like our God? One who pardons. One who has mercy and compassion. One whose love is demonstrated in such a way. Who's a pardoning God like thee? Israel replies now, and Judah standing by her side, as the prosecuting judge says, gazing at them, nothing more to say. Reduced from all boastfulness, all self-defense gone, stripped naked in the eyes of God, I've nothing to talk about regarding myself. Oh God, I owe everything to thee. Thou art the incomparable. No one stands by thy side. Thou art peerless. Thou art beyond the thought. O God, the incomparable God, I bow. No other could show mercy and pardon and cover up the guilt as thou hast done. And if Judah and Israel could talk like that, cannot we too? Through the work of Jesus Christ our Lord, we've been made co-heirs with himself. The marvel of the mercy and compassion of God, of God should fever our souls and reduce us with the realization of our own nothingness to worship and bowing at the feet of the Christ, the sheer adoration of that glorious one. We are nothing, absolutely nothing. He's everything, and he gave his all for you and for me. Who is a pardoning God like our God? Who has mercy and compassion as he? That's the one who we know. And thank God, despite all the failure, the shortcoming, all the deficiencies, all the weaknesses, he is still there, still the same. And the court comes to its conclusion. The sentences have already been indicated, and the story ends with mercy and compassion. The sentence was passed. It was borne by man, the God-man. The story for you and for me, in consequence, ends in mercy and compassion. Thank God it does.